In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I discuss why entrepreneurship is the logical path with guest Taylor Pearson. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 241. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. So where this week, Mike?
Well, the podcast site has been having some pretty weird issues lately. And people have been saying that, like, the site's down, and then I check it, and it looks like it's up for me. And then there's different websites you can go to where they're like, check to see if it's down for you or for everybody. And I go check those, and they say that it's not available. And I'm just like, well, it is working for me.
Oh, wow. So is it DNS?
That's what I thought at first. And then somebody tweeted a screenshot that showed a 503 error coming directly from the server. So I went and checked the server, and the error logs are completely empty. And I checked with support, and they're like, yeah, we haven't seen any 503 errors. And I'm just like, oh.
Weird.
Yeah. Somebody mentioned this on Twitter. This is one of those situations where cloud computing sucks because you can't just go over and kick the server.
Yeah, for real. Huh, I haven't experienced any issues with it, so that's a bummer. I hope it clears up.
I went into DNS and checked it pretty thoroughly, and everything seemed to be running fine, so I don't think that that was it. It seems like it might be the server, or it might be some sort of routing issues of some kind. So I don't know. They are aware of it. They're looking into it, but I don't think they're going to look too hard, to be honest, because it seems to be up and running.
Right. So, hey, we've added a speaker to the MicroConf Europe speaker docket. We have Alex from JITBIT, and he's attended several MicroConfs, but he runs a seven-figure software company that has a number of products, JITBIT Help Desk, JITBIT CRM. He has live chat, forum software, a bunch of other stuff. So if you've heard of JITBIT or you know Alex, you know his story is pretty cool. It's totally bootstrapped, and he's grown an admirable software company. So he'll be talking about his experience and pulling out some tactics and takeaways for our MicroConf Europe audience this August in Barcelona. How about you? What else have you been up to?
I think it was last week I launched the Audit Shark lockdown service to my mailing list, and it's been going reasonably well. I've already started on one that somebody purchased right away, and I've got two more that I'm in the process of scheduling, and then there seems to be more in the pipeline. So the service itself kind of solves a longstanding issue where people like the software, but they don't necessarily know what to do with the results. So instead of basically handing it off to them and they use the software, I use the software on their behalf and then interpret everything for them and do the work. And it essentially is a productized service, really, mm-hmm. but it kind of overcomes a lot of the challenges that the businesses who don't do this very often have been having with the software.
Sure. And especially if you're not targeting enterprises and not targeting folks with entire teams dedicated to this stuff, and you're mostly going after small and medium-sized businesses, they're not necessarily going to know what to do with those results. So having you as an expert come in, I think there's a lot of benefit to doing that. Now, is this a one-time audit where you fix? Is it a subscription? How does it work?
So there is essentially, it's a one-time audit. And then once we go through the audit and take a look at the results, probably takes several days to go through everything because we have an initial conversation first to kind of get a rundown of what their environment looks like. And then if anything needs to be built to go out into their environment, so like let's say they have something weird that I don't necessarily support out of the box, then I'll go build some stuff and then add it into the product and then go pull those results from their machines and then aggregate it into a report. And then once we sit down, go over everything in the report, depending on where they're at, then it might move into like a managed services opportunity where they can leverage me on a retainer basis in the future. And then there's also the opportunity for doing a follow-up audit in the future based on any sort of remediation efforts that they need to undertake. So let's say that there's 25 things that they need to fix based on the audits. They can go out and they can fix those things. Then we can come back in 3 months or 6 months or something like that and then take a look to see where they're at and whether those things were actually fixed and make sure that their environment's getting better over time and not worse.
All right. And this is for Windows servers only? Is that right?
No, it's for Windows, Linux, Unix, etc.
So if someone's listening to this and they're thinking, boy, I'd really like my server to be locked down more, how can they get in touch with you to hear more about this?
Well, they can email me directly, mtaber@auditshark.com, or they can just come over and sign up on the email list that's over on auditshark.com, and you'll get some brief information about what sorts of things you should be doing for your servers, and then there'll be a sales pitch that's kind of included in there at some point along the way where it'll talk a little bit more about the service and how if you're not ready to do this these things yourself, then we can come in and do them for you.
Cool. And you said you've already sold one, huh?
Yeah, several of them actually. And it's like one of them's in the process of being done right now, should be done by the end of this week. And then the other two, I'm in the process of scheduling. And then I've heard from other people that they're interested and they're just kind of working through paperwork and stuff like
that. Nice. So. Way to go, man. That's cool. That's good news.
Yep. So how about you?
Well, I have a couple of books that I wanted to recommend today. These are books that I've read over the past month or so. One is called Becoming Steve Jobs. And if you've read the Walter Isaacson biography, it is an exceptional book. I think it's just called Jobs, and I highly recommend it. And I actually recommend that more than this book. I liked this book a lot. This book did a good job of telling a different story. It's about kind of the psychological and mental development of Steve. It's written by a journalist who knew Steve from the 80s until his death. And he said that he felt like the Isaacson biography was a little harsh on Steve and that it made him out to be kind of a tyrant and a jerk who was hard to work with. And the journalist basically says that was true in the 80s and the early 90s. And then he kind of figured himself out. Like he matured, he became easier to work with. And from the mid 90s, like the Pixar era on, he was a much easier person to work with. And so that was his premise. I'm not sure that I totally buy that based on a lot of the stories you hear out of Isaacson's stuff, but it was a unique look at it. And I didn't feel like the same stories were rehashed in this book. And I'm a big fan of tech history and of Apple and all that stuff. I got my first computer. It was an Apple IIe back in 1982. So it kind of has a special place for me. And it was neat kind of to hear the other side of the story.
I haven't read that one, but I did read the Isaacson one, and it seemed to me like there was this, I don't want to call it a definitive turning point, but it definitely seemed like Steve Jobs kind of mellowed out a little bit. He definitely seemed like he still had some of those, I don't want to call it a mean streak, but like a streak about him where he knew what he wanted, and if you couldn't deliver, he was going to be pissed.
Yep.
So I don't think that those completely went away, but I think they feel like they were toned down a little bit once he came back and went through Pixar and had been laid off from Apple.
Yeah, it softened a bit, but it never went away. Like it was still part of his. And I think he always felt it, but he learned to not lose it when he felt that when he got older. Like it didn't go away for him mentally. It didn't come out as behaviors.
So he didn't pull a Balmer and throw a chair.
Exactly. Exactly. And hey, the other book that I wanted to recommend is, I wish I could remember who recommended this to me, but it's called Daily Rituals. And I thought that it was going to be this writer discussing a bunch of daily rituals and analyzing them and pulling commonalities. It's not. It's 150 short chapters. And all it is the daily ritual of some like famous creative person dating all the way back into the 1700s. There's composers, there's writers, there's artists. I think there are going to be maybe some tech people, just kind of anyone that he could pull daily rituals from. He's putting a chapter in there for him. And I have to say, it sounds like it'd be really bad or dry. It's actually really interesting. Maybe I'm just kind of a weirdo in this respect, but listening to people's daily rituals is giving me a couple ideas or some things that I want to improve. I've been struck by all these creatives had a daily ritual, even when it might change over time based on their life situation. Like some of them had kids and had to change it. But it's shocking that none of these people said, I'm going to be a creative and I'm just going to write when inspiration strikes. It really is a testament to having a routine if you're going to be someone who's trying to create and produce on a regular schedule.
Very cool.
Today, Mike and I have the pleasure of having Taylor Pearson on the podcast. Taylor has written a book called The End of Jobs. And if you're trying to get a frame of reference for where you might have heard Taylor's voice before, he worked for Dan and Ian. He ran a lot of their e-commerce marketing, and he's been on the Tropical MBA podcast several times. So Taylor, welcome. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So as I mentioned, Taylor wrote this book called The End of Jobs. And the main premise of the book is how investing in entrepreneurship is perhaps a more logical choice as times are changing. It's a more logical choice than having this salaried gig with the so-called stability of having a long-term job. And Taylor touches on a bunch of interesting things about how technology has shifted and has made jobs that were previously not possible, very much possible, and how it's made small niches that you could never have done 15 years ago lucrative enough that you could frankly quit your job and travel the world doing it. So Taylor, one of the things that I like about your book landing page, which is at taylorpearson.me/theendofjobs, is you have a really nice summary of it. And then you have this section that I always like to see, and it's who should read this book. And you have four different groups. You have early stage entrepreneurs, which makes sense because you're going to teach them how to get this going. You have established entrepreneurs. I like your explanation for this. You basically say, do you have friends who don't understand what you do? This book will help you convince folks that entrepreneurship is a reasonable choice. And then students and corporate employees. So with that introduction, would you mind giving folks your own summary of The End of Jobs to kind of give them a frame of reference of why this might be interesting to our audience?
Yeah, so the book kind of starts with me starting to work with Dan and Ian from the Tropical MBA. I started working with them in 2012. And at the time was basically just, I just wanted to travel. That was kind of my fundamental motivation. I wasn't overly interested in business. I just wanted to be able to go to the country. I wanted to travel. And so I learned a bunch of marketing skills and was working in a marketing agency at the time because I knew, you know, if I developed this skill set, I'd seen a lot of other people with the same skill set travel, and I knew I could do that. So I showed up to their conference in 2012 in Bangkok and didn't really know what was going on. But when I came back 2 years later in 2014, I kind of had seen some changes that were going on that kind of drove me to write this book, that a lot of my friends from Memphis, or I went to school in Birmingham, Alabama, were kind of on this same trajectory. And I was looking around at the people in Bangkok and there weren't any like innate differences. It was like very clear sitting in the room, like my friends at home were smart and the people in Bangkok were smart. And that in a lot of ways, the difference was just that they had a better choice, that the opportunities they were pursuing as entrepreneurs were better opportunities. And a lot of that was driven by kind of the changing nature of technology and the impact that's had on jobs and on work.
So one of the things you say in the book, you talk about how the internet has made stair-stepping possible, and you talk a lot about the long tail and how that works. Would you mind explaining to folks what the long tail is and why it helps entrepreneurs get started these days?
So the long tail was a concept that a writer for Wired magazine named Chris Anderson came up with. And basically what he saw happening was there were kind of three forces of technology and more specifically the internet. The first was this democratization of the tools of production. So if you look back 20 years or 50 years ago, if you wanted to make something, even something like a digital product, which now we think of as like so easy to make, if you wanted to make a record album, which was a digital product 20 or 30 years ago, you had to go into a studio and you had to rent out the studio space and you had to record this like expensive equipment. And now people do this like GarageBand on their computer. And that's true kind of across industries, like the rise of SaaS and all these software tools to kind of democratize production. It's getting easier to manufacture in China. It's getting easier to make things. The other thing that's happening is this democratization of distribution. So, you know, again, you go back 50 years, and if you wanted distribution, you basically had to go on NBC, ABC, CBS. That there were a very limited number of distribution channels, and, you know, that's evolved. We went to cable, and we've slowly moved, like, onto YouTube. And this is, it's kind of cliche now, but kind of the middlemen are dying. This is true across distribution channels from video to text to audio, like podcasting and blogging. All of a sudden, for very cheap compared to what it cost 20 years ago, anyone can establish and build a distribution channel. And then the other thing is that algorithms have basically connected these to the distribution and the product creation. So I know we could talk about this a little more, Rob. I know you had a duck boats ebook at some point.
I did. It was plans, actually, for building a duck boat with like stuff, yeah, stuff you could buy at Home Depot.
And what's interesting is you couldn't have built that 20 years ago, or you couldn't have sold that product 20 years ago because there just weren't, like, you're not going to go to the neighborhood farmer's market and set up a shop and sell the Duck Boats ebook. That you have to have the internet, and more specifically, you have to have Google to connect people that are looking with that Duck Boat ebook to someone that can produce the Duck Boat ebook and can do it for much cheaper and can distribute it much more effectively than was possible. And this is kind of enabled when you look at all these businesses that we're going to talk about that are stair-step businesses. They've been enabled by all this technology around the long tail. And it's not only continuing and that these are getting more accessible, but it's accelerating.
Right. And that you brought up the stair step. I mean, that one of the two paths that you outline are scripts, I think you're calling them, right? It's kind of like, don't follow the script of get the 9-to-5 and work for 40 years like our culture tells us to, but follow one of these alternative scripts. And one of them is stair stepping, which we obviously talk a lot about on the podcast here. And the other one is apprenticeships. And I think if you want to hear more about apprenticeships, folks can read your book. We're not going to have time to cover them in depth today, but we are going to talk about some examples of stair-stepping and mindset behind that.
So as part of this democratization of the internet kind of gives everybody in terms of being able to create a product of some kind and then distribute it essentially on your own, does that render a lot of the existing distribution channels more or less irrelevant? Because you've kind of said those middle players are getting squeezed and they're kind of being pushed out of existence. And you could say, okay, well, they're getting pushed out of existence or they're getting put into a position where they simply become larger. Is that the case, or are they just simply being pushed out of existence and they're not getting any bigger because of the internet making everything accessible to everyone else?
Well, they're certainly losing market share. Like, if you look at video content being consumed, you can look at the pie charts where, you know, 3 years ago, it was 100% between, I think, NBC, ABC, and CBS were the three original ones. And now it's like 20% YouTube and 2% Vimeo and 30% cable. And so the overall market share is definitely getting much smaller for established players, and it's getting much larger in general for these like new distribution channels. And so as those grow and gain market share, people that are investing in them are obviously getting a part of that market share.
Well, sure. But I mean, isn't the overall size of the market increasing? So the question would be, even though if their market share may be getting smaller, does that mean that they are getting smaller as well?
I guess it depends on the industry. Like, if you look at book publishing, I would say it seems like they are getting smaller. The publishing companies, some of those smaller publishing houses are going out of business. How that affects like the very, very top of the market, I'm not sure. I guess the point in my mind is the opportunity here for individuals or for entrepreneurs is that these very accessible distribution channels like YouTube, Google, like social, are very cheap and they're getting more and more powerful. And that's what individuals have access to. So kind of, I guess, regardless of what happens with the bigger players, there's still more opportunity for individuals.
So in terms of more opportunity and making everything more accessible, can you talk a little bit about some of the problems that some people might have in recognizing some of those opportunities?
Yeah, so I think one of the reasons we don't see a lot of these opportunities is we have this very local bias. Like, we have Dunbar's number is kind of what's frequently cited, that we're used to these tribes of 150 people, and that's how our minds work. And we think, you know, well, if I only have one friend that likes this, then there's probably only one friend, one person in the whole world. That's the cognitive bias we have. But, you know, I'd say there's, you know, going back to the duck boats example, maybe there's only 10,000 people in the U.S. that like duck boats. But if 10,000 people like duck boats and all of them pay $100 for an ebook, that's $1 million in revenue.
Cool. So let's talk a little more about stair stepping. I mentioned this earlier. There are obviously a lot of examples of folks doing this, some of whom we've had on the show, like Phil Dirksen is a good example with his WordPress plugins. He was in an episode a few months ago called 8 Years to Overnight Success. And David Heenberger, who also has WordPress plugins, he runs Fat Cat Apps. He's stair stepping his way up. And Free Davies, he's also in the DC, and he does Magento plugins, if I recall. There are a bunch more. We don't need to list them all here. What are some good examples that you've come across in maybe other areas? Because, you know, it's not all about software, just because this podcast is. There are certainly people doing this in publishing, maybe in e-commerce, productized service, that kind of stuff. What are the stair-stepping examples that you've come across?
So kind of going back to this idea of these new distribution channels or these new markets are expanding, the thing I noticed looking at people in other industries is they tend to ride that raising tide. So like you see a lot of, I know you'll talk about WordPress plugins, that as that WordPress ecosystem is expanding, a rising tide raises all boats. And so kind of getting in the ground level of that, as more and more people come to WordPress, even if nothing else changes about you don't improve the marketing, you don't improve anything else, there's still going to be more potential customers for that product. And so that's true in other markets as well. Like, one I see a lot of people in right now is Amazon, that as more and more people shop on Amazon and Amazon makes their platform more and more available to sellers, a lot of people have gotten businesses moving very quickly by just using this existing and growing Amazon distribution channel and putting their products or white labeling products on that distribution distribution channel. I see the same thing. Like if you look at Ramit Sethi's trajectory, kind of like stair-stepping his way up in info products. So he sort of, I think his first info product was like $9. And he likes to talk about this all the time. That like he went from $9 info product and then he did his Earn 1K course, which I think was a few hundred dollars. And now he's moved to selling like $10,000 courses, that he's gradually kind of moved up this value chain. And then the same thing tends to happen with productized services, that people will come in and test a productized service, usually very cheap since it's mostly their time and labor. And then over time, as they move up the market, they can afford to charge more and more for the same service. So if you're doing email marketing for a small business, you can't contribute the amount of value you can for a large business. But it does kind of let you get momentum and trajectory, and you get to understand how the processes work. You get referrals up the market into new customers, and again, like stair-step up the value chain.
I think in many ways, some of these things in terms of the stair-step approach, not just in terms of different types of products, but even within an individual product, like you said, Ramit Sethi's different info products or productized services, pretty much any of these types of products where you could sell it for a little bit or you could sell it for a huge amount of money based on who your customer is. Even though at its core, the product itself is generally the same thing. It's just a matter of where it is that you're selling it in terms of like the small business versus the large business. But it seems to me like there's a correlation between how long you've been doing it and the experience that you've had doing it as to how much you can charge for it and the types of businesses you can sell it to just based on the amount of experience that you have doing it and the amount of value that you're providing. And it's not as if you could step in and like Ramit Sethi couldn't have created this $1,000 product and sold it as well as he has on day one, because not only did he not have the experience, but he didn't have the credibility and he didn't have the knowledge that goes along with all the different marketing efforts that need to be in place in order to make that $1,000 product worth it. And he basically practiced those things at that lower level first.
Absolutely. You can tell with those businesses, they just have so much momentum at this point. They've been doing it and they have all the systems in place and they have the people in place, and it gets easier and easier to launch bigger and bigger products. And I think the other thing that doesn't get talked about as much is kind of the mindset issues. I know everyone, I vividly remember the first time I made a dollar on the internet. And it was kind of like this like magical moment of like, oh my God, you can make money on the internet. That was nothing I'd ever done before. I didn't know anyone that had ever made money on the internet. But that kind of progression continues to move up. And as you have one successful product launch in your belt or one successful product or company or plugin, you kind of gain the confidence to move into bigger and bigger projects. And you can see that in Ramit's trajectory, that he's much more confident now in his writing and his sales and presentation than he was 5 years ago.
Yeah, and I would venture to say that he's much more competent at it as well. That's something I grew in over time. If you look back at any of the copy that I wrote back in 2007, 2008 versus what I write today, it's night and day. I cringe now. The stuff that I wrote back then worked well enough, but I didn't know what I was doing in a lot of senses. In addition, there's so many aspects that I feel like stair-stepping contributes to, right? It's like there's true competence. You just get better at something. There's also confidence that you can do it, and that helps make you more competent because it just builds over time and you can start tackling bigger and bigger things, and you're willing to risk bigger and bigger things because it's a little more calculated, right? It's not like you're putting all the chips on the table for this huge moonshot. You've basically worked your way up there and you kind of deserve to be there. And then I also think that kind of like a network effect, or maybe it's better said as like relationships, because if Ramit came out of the gate and tried to sell a $10,000 product without having sold all these other products, people are just much less likely to buy it. I think that we did the same thing with the Micropreneur Academy, which is a little lower priced, and then launching MicroConf, which is obviously a more expensive event because it's an in-person thing. It would have been a lot harder for us to just suddenly jump out of the gate without having the podcast, without having my book and the Academy and all this stuff. Like, just it takes time. And I think the mistake that I see people doing when they're not stair-stepping is that they know it's going to take time, but they spend 2 years building something and never launching. So you're not getting the experience. You're not really gaining in confidence. And if it fails, you're really trucked. You can't do much. But if during that 2 years, instead you launch some smaller efforts, whether it's a podcast or a blog or a dropship e-commerce site or a WordPress plugin, then you can start gaining these things. By the time you get to the end of the 2 years, coming back to what you said earlier, there's a ton of momentum. I mean, I view stair stepping as a real big momentum play, right? That the longer you do it, the faster that flywheel starts spinning.
I thought about it again, kind of another analogy was if you look at competitive weightlifting or I do amateur powerlifting competitions sometimes, the people who end up doing the best, the way it works is you have three attempts. They usually start at a low number and move up to a much higher number and kind of take these jumps that the people that try to start at a higher number usually end up failing because they don't kind of get the confidence and the momentum of kind of building up gradually and being able to get eventually a higher outcome.
Yep. And I think the same can be said for playing a sport. Let's say play baseball and you start in the little league, and then you play high school and then you play college and then maybe you go minor leagues and then eventually you get to the pros. But you don't just try to jump into the pros when you're 25, having never done anything before.
And coming back a little bit full circle to the importance of the long tail is it didn't used to be possible to gain that momentum. Like if you had to lease a storefront and you had to have all this startup capital and you had to pay for advertising in a newspaper or whatever it was, like it was very expensive to start gaining momentum. Whereas now, because of basically the internet, it's very, very cheap.
Yeah, that's interesting to think about. Like not stair-stepping and kind of building your way up is perhaps could be thought of as a mindset that people had 20, 30 years ago, because it really wasn't an option to do this, or it was very difficult. I don't know anyone who was doing it back then.
One of the topics that I talked about in my book was competition and how you can't let competition essentially either stifle you or push you away from choosing to go after a particular niche product or a type of market. What sorts of thoughts do you have on that and how that competition in the market plays into the types of markets that you can get into and the types of products that you can develop?
I think one role competition plays is a lot of competition usually means a growing market. And even a growing market with a lot of competition, you'll still do very well. And so like going back to the WordPress ecosystem, you know, it didn't exist 15 years ago. And sure, there was, you know, if you asked someone 5 years ago, is there a lot of competition in WordPress? They would have said yes. But businesses that came in and grew with that ecosystem, even though there was a lot of competition, it's just naturally grown. And you look at, you know, a bigger example of this might be like Airbnb and Craigslist. First, there was Craigslist, and that was how people found housing, and Airbnb just like sliced off a little part of Craigslist, right? Like, we're just going to do vacation rentals, and they actually, like, I think had some API rigged up where they were automatically posting their listings to Craigslist to bring people over. And now you see people that build businesses on the back of Airbnb, and they rent out houses. And this, like, gradual, even as there's more and more competition because the market's growing, everyone's growing and everyone's making more money.
So the idea isn't that you should stay away from competition. It's that you should kind of embrace it, because especially in those places where the market size is growing, because it gives you greater opportunities.
Yeah, like a rising tide raises all boats. And Richard Koch has actually written a great book about this called The Star Principle, and he kind of goes through the math of it. But if you kind of look at a growing market and compound interest, that picking the right market is... or picking a growing market is more important than almost any other decision when entering into a new market or a new niche. And even if there's a bunch of competition, as long as the market's growing quickly, there's always going to be new opportunities. You can always niche down as that market gets bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, as Craigslist got bigger and bigger and bigger, Airbnb just carved off like a little niche. You could carve off a little niche of, again, WordPress with WordPress plugins.
Yeah, it's interesting you say this, because as we pivoted Drip from being just more of an autoresponder email marketing service and we pivoted into marketing automation, I did a lot of research into the marketing automation space, and I found out that it was growing very quickly, and that the projections, like Gartner's projections and all these other projections, are that this market is getting substantially larger over the next 3 years, I think. And that was one of the, I won't say it was the reason we did it. I mean, we were being asked by customers to build this, but it definitely encouraged me to enter this market, even though it was many months of development to get into it, because I figured that no matter what, even if we occupied a small niche, it's still a small niche that a lot of people are flooding into, and that there are going to be, you know, folks looking for the service. So it's an intuitive thing, I think, but it's nice to hear there's a lot of other, I guess, either research or other opinions supporting that premise.
Yeah, if you haven't read The Star Principle, I'd definitely take a look. He lays out the math, and I can't remember off the top of my head, but basically the premise is as long as you can be the number one player in a growing market, almost everything else doesn't matter as long as you can hold that number one position and as long as the market keeps growing. And obviously the opportunity we kind of talk about is this idea to take a niche section of a growing market where there isn't a clearly established one and kind of cement yourself as the established player.
Right. Yeah, I've read the book, actually. And okay. Yeah, it's good. But what's nice is that you pretty much summarize the entire book in those three sentences, because that's kind of the premise, right? I think it's the market is you want to be the number one player and the market should be growing at least 20 to 30% per year. Those are kind of his two criteria. I don't necessarily agree that you have to be the number one player. I think if you've raised funding and you want to become a $100 million company, then yeah, probably, right? You do need to be number one. But I think you can carve out a perfectly livable six or seven figure business, bootstrapped, and not need to be number one in a market like this, right? Especially something like, whatever, email marketing or marketing automation or WordPress. They're so huge that you can carve out a full-time living with just a tiny sliver of that market.
My perception is what he's talking about, and like Mark Andreessen talks about this as well, is like taking a section in the market. So like I know Nathan Barry is he's marketing for authors, or, you know, like being able to pick a niche and be the number one in that niche of, you know, Infusionsoft is like massive marketing automation, but it's not clear if they're kind of, or what their niche particularly is.
Right. I think their niche is SMBs, right? It's small, medium-sized businesses.
Yeah.
Because the players that were there before them, which are like Pardot, Marketo, and Silverpop, those guys all went enterprise. I mean, their pricing was $1,000 a month and up, and it was all high-touch sales, right? With these big lifetime values. Infusionsoft, as far as I know, was the first player to come in and be $200, $300 a month, which at the time for marketing automation was cheap. Yep, yeah. That was their niche, right? They were going for the SMBs. And now you have Drip coming in under Infusionsoft, and there are, you know, other players doing that as well. And you even have MailChimp trying to move up a little bit by adding some of their automation. So I do think there's room. If the market is big enough, there are a lot of niches in it that can make you $10,000 a month, and that's plenty to live on in most places on Earth.
Absolutely.
So to switch it up a little bit, I'm curious, why did you choose to write this book? Like, was it something that you felt so strongly the world needed to hear that you wanted to get it down and communicate it? Is it something you've been thinking about for years, or was it just kind of a stroke of insight and you dove in and did it? Why did you decide to put this on paper?
I guess all of the above is probably the honest answer. I think what frustrated me looking out into the market and a lot of the ways people talk about entrepreneurship is that a lot of the narrative around it is very much based on, one is either this like escape the cubicle narrative of like get away and everything's terrible and your corporate job sucks. And no one was really having an intelligent discussion about like the real merits of entrepreneurship as kind of a intelligent decision, not as like follow your passion or an escape the cubicle one. And that was the way I was thinking about it. And that was the way I saw a lot of other entrepreneurs around me thinking about it. And I wanted to kind of insert that narrative into the dialogue. And I think that there's a better case for entrepreneurship under those premises as not a just a follow your passion thing, but as an intelligent, reasoned life decision.
Yeah, I like it as a complement to all the tactical stuff, right? There's a lot of places, there's a lot of books, podcasts, blog posts, et cetera, about how to do it. But I think you're starting to look here at why you should do it. And beyond the freedom reason, right? We know that you should do it for the freedom and the ability to live where you want and hang out with who you want and spend more time with your family and all that kind of stuff. But you really look at it from even a higher level point of view, right? It's like why this could potentially be a more logical choice than long-term salaried employment.
Yes, and how the kind of changing market conditions and what the trends are going forward, that as we see kind of globalization move faster and faster and outsourcing move faster and faster and technology move faster and faster, that a lot of the intelligence that kind of evolved over the 20th century around long-term stable employment isn't necessarily true anymore. That a lot of the promises or the implicit promises that were made to the younger generation based on what happened to the older generation aren't necessarily true. That the nature of markets and the way things are moving and changing so fast is people have to be able to adapt to those markets, and they have to develop a skill set around not just implementing kind of known systems and known solutions, but being able to innovate and create and connect their own.
Right, because there's even a school of thought that anything that is not a kind of a creative job is either going to be outsourced to a place where it's cheaper, or frankly, the computers and or robots are going to take over. Right. I mean, and I don't mean take over in the Terminator type way, but they're going to slowly do more and more of our jobs, including things like driving trucks, driving cars with self-driving car movement, like taking orders at a drive-thru. Like, I think it's 10, 15 years till we have a computer that has good enough voice recognition and can interact with someone to where you don't need that person, you know, taking a food order anymore. I know that obviously we're going to have waiters and waitresses for the foreseeable future, but they're already having iPads or tablets at tables where you can order, and you need fewer and fewer of those folks. So there's certainly a case to be made for kind of moving up the chain in terms of creativity. Activity and developing your skill set, which I think is one of the premises here of your book.
Yeah, we've seen, I guess it's the two-sided coin, that the glass ceiling is kind of disappearing, but so is the glass floor, in that sense that a lot of these kind of predictable, safe, middle-class jobs, you know, I talked to a friend that's does web design. He's kind of saying the junior web designers are disappearing because you've had software comes in that lets you do basically junior web design as like drag and drop templates. And that kind of work, that kind of routine work, is being phased out.
So Taylor, you're doing something interesting with your book. Not only are you giving the book away for the first 5 days it's available, but you're also giving away a number of business books when you launch. Could you tell us a little bit about that and where folks can go if they want to be notified when your book is available for free here at the end of the month?
I am. So there's a great quote by Charlie Jones that says, the person you will be in 5 years is kind of the sum of the five people you spend the most time around and the books you read. And that's certainly been true of me and with a lot of people I've seen, that the books they've read have been a big impact. So I wanted to give away the books that I felt have been the biggest influence on me and have been recommended to me over the past 5 years. So I put together 67 books. They're my 67 favorite books on entrepreneurship. It's $1,300 worth of books, and I'm going to be giving them away for 10 days from June 15th to June 27th. So if people want to jump in that, I'm giving away the books, and then I'll let everyone that joins know about when the book is free on Amazon as well.
Cool. And that's at taylorpearson.me/winbooks. And they can sign up to both win the books and, like you said, to be notified, because your book, The End of Jobs, is going to be available for free on Amazon for 5 days. And then after that, it's going to cost whatever, $10 or $20. So if they want to hear about it when it's free, they can enter their email at that page.
Yep.
Awesome. And if folks want to keep up with you aside from this, what's your Twitter handle or anywhere else they can keep up with you?
My Twitter handle is C Taylor M Pearson, or you can email me, taylor@taylorpearson.me.
Sounds great, man. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks everyone for listening.
If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690 or email it to us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupsfortherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.